The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Our guest, Margaret Burnham, is the founding director of the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project, an initiative to document every racially motivated killing in the South between 1930 and 1970. In her new book, By Hands Now Known, Burnham expands her analysis of the astonishing violence of the Jim Crow era to investigate the legal apparatus that held up this infamously cruel system and its still reverberating legacy. Burnham is a distinguished professor of law at Northeastern University. She was nominated by President Biden and confirmed by the U.S. Senate to serve on the Civil Rights Cold Case Records Review Board, and she formerly worked as a lawyer for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and as a staffer for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Author Sadia Hartman writes, in this necessary and important book, Burnham addresses the enormous violence necessary to sustain Jim Crow through a series of compelling case studies about the lives destroyed by the brutal regime of separate but equal. In reckoning with the impact of this history on the present, Burnham asks how he might undo or redress this legacy of violence. It is timely and essential reading. Tonight, Professor Burnham will be in conversation with award-winning broadcaster and journalist and our longtime friend, Tracy Matisak. Please welcome Margaret Burnham and Tracy Matisak to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you all for being with us here at the Free Library. We are delighted to see you, and as Andy may have mentioned, we have saved some time at the end of our conversation for your questions for Professor Burnham. So if something occurs to you, maybe just jot it down and make a note of it, and we'll get through as many questions as we can before we wrap up for the evening. So that said, Professor Burnham, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Well, thanks so much, Tracy. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, thank you so much for writing this book, and the subtitle of the book is Jim Crow's Legal Executioners, and it challenges the reader with this question: if the law cannot protect a person from lynching, then isn't lynching the law? And you argue that at least until the mid-20th century, it was.
Yeah, I make the argument in the book, thanks so much for that, I make the argument in the book that to the extent that laws on the books that were meant to protect folks, and here I'm talking about African Americans, were ineffectual. It was then the norms and practices that became the law. So everyone understood what they could get away with and what they might be subjected to in respect to the violence that I talk about in the book. And so that is, in effect, the law, even though it clearly violates the law.
And you chose to center the book in the early to mid-20th century. Why that time period?
So I started this project in 2007. And what drew me to the project was a law passed by Congress and signed by President Bush. It's called the Emmett Till Cold Case Act. And the point of the Emmett Till Cold Case Act was to motivate prosecutors across the country in the South and federal prosecutors to pick up cold cases from the late 1960s, early 1970s, and the 1950s to determine whether or not new prosecutions, fresh prosecutions, re-prosecutions were possible. So I looked at the statute and I said, well, there's probably a lot that I can do and that law students can do to move this project forward. What we quickly learned was that neither the FBI, the DOJ, nor local authorities really were really going to pursue any such prosecutions for a range of reasons. And so I began to look at this earlier period, which I think is a bit of a black hole in our history, the 1930s and 1940s, and to think about how we might help those families who suffered the same sorts of losses, that is to say, homicidal racial violence, but whose stories had never been told. Yeah. And so we began collecting those stories, first by looking at the black press, and then by collecting documents from the National Archives, and then finally putting the documents together with the memories of families across the country. Yeah.
So in the time since you founded the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project at Northeastern, how many cases would you say you've reviewed?
I'd say we've looked at thousands of cases. We launched our archive, made public the archive that we'd been creating earlier this week, on two or three days ago. And it's called the CRRJ. One can reach it, the public can reach it and explore the cases. It's called the CRRJarchive.org. That collection holds about 1,000 cases from the period 1930 to 1955, and many, many documents. There are currently about 12,000 documents in the archive. Ultimately, there'll be about 25,000 documents in the archive. Putting this history together and rendering it publicly available.
Of those cases, how many of them would you say there was some degree of justice that was done?
I'd say none. I'd say in none of these cases was there any degree of justice. There were a few cases where there were prosecutions, most of which were reversed on appeal. Prosecutions and guilty pleas. Very, very few cases. Prosecutions and guilty convictions. Those were reversed on appeal. There are a few cases in which there were guilty pleas and then very, very short sentences. So I would say in none, zero of those cases would justice, here, you know, in quotations, have been obtained.
And among other things, you want the reader to understand how the seemingly most innocuous encounters between a black person and a white person, and oftentimes any white person, not even somebody in law enforcement necessary, could lead to that black person's death or to injury anytime, any place. And in fact, you open the book with the story of Mrs. Hunter as a case in point. Can you talk a little bit about her story?
Yeah, so exactly. So let's start with her, because her case certainly is emblematic of the kind of humdrum, ho-hum, everyday, quotidian violence that prevailed during this period of time and that folks had to basically live with. I had to decide whether how they were going to engage with the possibility, the constant possibility of violence. So Ollie Hunter's name really doesn't appear in any documents having to do with the case. We discovered what her name was. This is a 60-odd-year-old woman. The town is Donelsonville, Georgia. It's a very small town. The year is, I think, 1942, 1943. And the NAACP receives a letter from an individual whose gender and race is unknown, and who writes about a killing that occurred in his town, and he doesn't have the victim's name. He doesn't know her name is Ollie Hunter. He says that this woman went into a store on the main street in the town. You guys can imagine what those towns were like and how, you know, short and simple the streets were, two or three stores. And she picked up a can of oil. And something about her demeanor troubled the storekeeper, who was a white man in his 20s. He followed her out of the store, and he beat her to death with an axe. That was the end of her life. And we were able to find out who she was by looking through, combing through all of the death certificates from Donaldsonville, Georgia, involving a woman in her late middle age, African-American woman in her late middle age, around the time this incident happened. And so there are two documents in the archive on the Ollie Hunter case. The original letter, written shortly after the event, from the NAACP, and her death certificate. That's all that remains. Mm-hmm. We have searched low and high and low to find her family members unsuccessfully, searched high and low to find out where she was buried unsuccessfully, have some idea about who the perpetrator was, but can't say for certain. And if it's who we think he was sent off very quickly to the service. There are no legal documents. There are no complaints, state complaints, county complaints. There is no police report. All there remains is this letter. And so the case, you know, tells us a tremendous amount about our project. It tells us, first of all, how these cases were invisibilized. And it tells us, as you suggested a moment ago, how a lethal assault could turn into an ordinary encounter in the eyes of the assailant.
Yeah. And you also make the point that local officials and just local people tended to have much more authority over the lives of black people than the federal government did during those years.
Well, this is complicated. What I say, the federal government had the tools but didn't use them to intervene in the violence, in this massive pandemic of violence across the South. What I also say, and this is a slightly different point, is that the enforcers of Jim Crow included not just those deputized and badged to carry out the precepts of Jim Crow, but also included any white person. Any white person was in effect privileged to enforce the Jim Crow rules. And I make this point specifically with respect to buses. I have a chapter in the book where I talk about violence on buses that, you know, led to the death of black folk who were protesting perhaps in overt ways and perhaps, you know, subversively protesting Jim Crow rules, and who ended up dead at the hands of bus drivers who at that point were armed. This is not a new point. It's been made about, you know, the slavery era and the post-slavery era, that essentially the enforcement of these rules lay in the hands of the white community in general, not just in the hands of those authorized by law to enforce them.
Since you mentioned buses, I wanted to ask you about one of the themes of the book, which is the relationship between black mobility and black freedom, and how public transportation became a venue for all kinds of racial animosities to play out. And you use the example of black soldiers in particular, and how even in uniform, they could not escape the violence oftentimes, and the federal government, as you've pointed out, oftentimes abdicated its responsibility to protect them. Would you share maybe an example or two of how that played out?
Yeah, thank you, Tracy. So, yeah, I've chosen transportation soldiers World War II as a space to illustrate the arguments that I make in the book, because it's an intersection of local law, federal law, and not just DOJ, but also the War Department and state law. And so all of these players are concerned with violence that was particularly sharp with respect to soldiers who were forced to travel across the South, Jim Crow, and who in many cases weren't accustomed to it because they'd come from They come from the North. And Booker Spicely's case is a great example. Booker Spicely is a young man born in Blackstone, Virginia, who moved to Philadelphia after his sister had come here and worked as a nurse's aide for many, many years. His sister and his brother was a chef in Philadelphia, and Booker passed through until he joined the Army. The Army shipped him to Durham, North Carolina. And this is early 1940s, I believe 1944, or maybe perhaps 1942. Booker Spicely is stationed at Camp Butner outside of Durham. It's a Saturday night. He's in uniform. He's had a good day in downtown Durham. He's headed back home. He gets on the bus, sits close to the back, but not at the back, and a white soldier gets on the bus, also headed back home after Saturday in town to Camp Butner. The bus driver tells Booker, get up and make room for this white soldier who is the same rank, same position as Booker Spicely. Spicely protests. He says, I'm not accustomed to this where I come from, meaning perhaps Philadelphia. And the words are then exchanged. Booker Spicely, realizing that the bus driver is getting angrier and angrier, tries to apologize, is not able to resolve his argument with the bus driver. Gets off the bus, is followed off the bus by the bus driver, who shoots and kills him to death, leaves him lying on the sidewalk. Gets back on his bus and drives away. And so I use that story both to emphasize how both random and devastating and lethal these encounters could be. But I also used it to talk about what the federal government did. And here I'm talking about the Army. So the Army investigated the Booker's, first of all, the NAACP got involved. The Army then takes up the investigation. They send an undercover African-American man to Durham, North Carolina. And his job is to determine the level and nature of resistance in the African-American community, not to investigate the bus driver, not to determine what, if anything, the Army should do to vindicate the death of its soldier, but rather to move from cafe to cafe, from workplace to workplace in the African-American community and find out who's protesting and where are they getting their instructions from. Not only does the Army send this man to Durham, they also send someone up to Philadelphia, in Philadelphia, where his sister is urging the local NAACP to take up the Booker Spicely case. And not only Philadelphia, they furthermore send someone up to spy on the Booker Spicely family in Blackstone, where his funeral took place. That was the role of the federal government in the early 1940s. This is after the war has begun, so it's 1944, I believe. And after we've committed to fighting a war for democracy across the seas, this is representative, illustrative, one of many incidences of violence faced by African-American soldiers who thought, okay, I'm doing my part. I got my uniform on. Uncle Sam has called me. Here I am. And yet this is what they were confronted with.
In tracing a direct line from slavery to the present day, you talk about the idea of rendition, and that was sort of the Jim Crow era version of like the fugitive slave law. Black people who were trying to get away from all manner of troubles, legal issues, and so forth in the South came north. Many of them ended up in Detroit, you point out, but their troubles didn't always end when they got up north. What exactly was rendition, and why was Detroit such a popular place for black people to end up?
So rendition essentially means is the process, the legal process by which one state seeks to obtain to require another state to arrest and send back a citizen of the demanding state so that they can be tried. So Detroit ends up to be a place where many people, obviously Detroit, jobs, et cetera, growing black community, but it ends up to be particularly illustrative here because there's a legal community in Detroit, African-American, mostly men at that point, who had studied law and were deeply engaged in trying to protect these folks who had escaped lynchings or other forms of violence in the South and ended up in these African-American communities. I think the case that's probably most relevant here involves a 16-year-old boy who left the county of Elbert, Georgia, in 1942. Let me tell you his story. His name is Thomas Maddox. And he got into a road fight in 1942. His two sisters are in the car. He's driving a car. Some white boys pass by. Again, words are passed. They get out of the car, start attacking his sisters. He defends them. One of the white boys gets cut. Thomas Maddox, 16, realizes, and his family realize immediately, he has to get out of Dodge. They put him on a train, and he ends up with family here in Philadelphia. He goes to a hospital, gets himself fixed up, and then lives with relatives in Philadelphia. Meantime, the entire family, Maddox family, back in Elbert County, is arrested. The kids, the girls, the mother, everyone's thrown in jail and beaten. The state of Georgia seeks the return. By the way, the young boy who was cut, a couple of stitches, went home. The state of Georgia seeks the return of Thomas Maddox. Raymond Pace Alexander hears about the case from Thurgood Marshall and begins to advocate for the Pennsylvania to deny the rendition warrant. There's a long legal process that involves very fancy footwork on the part of the lawyers, and ultimately a wonderful opinion from a Philadelphia judge, his name is Judge Fennerty, I've forgotten the first name, who agrees with Pace Alexander and Marshall, who's prepared an amicus brief in this case, to keep Maddox in Philadelphia. Ultimately, his whole family joins him here, and they still live. The Maddox family still lives right here in Philadelphia. So that's the kind of case that I talk about in this chapter of the book. And of course, most of the cases that I use in the book are really focused on Detroit, because the folks who moved to Detroit, they all moved to a place called Black Bottom, which many of you may know from the August Wilson play of the same name. And so I use Detroit really as the example, but Philadelphia too, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Rochester, all of these are places which received folks running away from the Jim Crow South, just as slaves had previously escaped to these places. And what happens in the rendition period is it knits together a national African-American community. Detroit also, because Detroit had the largest NAACP branch in the country in the 1930s and 1940s.
You know, when we think of black resistance, it's tempting to go right to the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. But you make the case that there was a very active civil rights movement well before that, particularly in Birmingham, where black people were being killed for the flimsiest of reasons. And you describe it as being kind of a forerunner of the Black Lives Matter movement. Can you talk about what that resistance looked like and how successful was it?
Well, its success can be found in the seeds it laid for the later civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s. That movement would never have emerged but for the struggles that took place in the 1930s and 1940s. Scholars talk about the long civil rights movement, suggesting that it doesn't start in 1954 with the Brown versus Board of Education case, but rather it goes back beginning in the 1930s. Obviously, struggle is deeply descriptive of African American life and culture forever across our lives in this country. But you know, as we think about it and try to understand it, conceptualize it, theorize it, we also have to think about epochs and eras and how that one differs from the other. And so I look at this 1930s, 1940s period in Birmingham because Birmingham was really a hotbed. It was a violent city, it was a labor town, and it was also a hotbed of resistance long before Martin Luther King ever gets there, Shuttlesworth, any of them ever get there. Birmingham had a long before the bombings on Bombington, it was called Bombington, back in the 1940s. A lot of this emerges because African Americans become active and accustomed to formal organizing traditions during the labor movements of the 1930s and then into the 1940s. Those experiences are then useful as the African American community gets battered over and over and over again by brutal policing in Birmingham that claims so many lives during the 1940s. So you have a press, you have a very active African American press, obviously you have a religious community, and so you have formal mechanisms of protest, the petitions, the boycotts, the visits to City Hall, but also far less formal. So you have, you know, both these very formal reformist modalities of protest, but you also have both radical and subversive and sort of underground forms of protest that again knit together a black community across class lines, across differences within that community, and begin to define Birmingham as a city of struggle.
You write about the need for redress for these families, for the descendants of those who were killed simply because of their race. You make a strong case for reparations. Can you address why reparations are necessary and what they ought to look like?
Okay, so pull these cases into the larger landscape and discourse around reparations. Reparations has clearly been an anchor of African American struggle for 100 years. So, the recently emerging discussions and activity around reparations is certainly nothing new. What I argue here is there is a class of survivors / victims who are particularly deserving, mm-hmm. not deserving, deserving is the wrong word, who are a particularly fit group for reparations. And that group, that category, are the family members of those who lost their loved ones to this the kind of Jim Crow violence mm-hmm. that I describe in the book. Now, that's my case. You know, folks will add, they may subtract. But what I say is that, you know, when we talk about reparations, we're really thinking about can we define who it is? Can we define what's owed? Can we say anything about who owes? And I argue that in this case, all three things are clear. We know who lost, we know what they were entitled to, and we know it was our government, the failures of our government, the flaws in our laws that led to their deaths.
So would you say, practically speaking, an acknowledgement, financial compensation, what would that, what form would
that
take?
Well, you know, I'm throwing it out there. I'm throwing it out there, and it's for that community
yeah.
to figure out what those demands mm. should be, not
yeah.
for me.
Yeah.
It's for that community. And it's an organized community. It's an organization called the Legacy Coalition, which is comprised of the family members who we've worked with and who others, Brian Stevenson and others across yeah. the country, have worked with. And they've come together, and they are, savvy politicians, politically savvy, and knowledgeable about the reparations movement and know exactly when, where, and what they ought to ask for.
I'm curious, Professor, as you and your research partner, Melissa Nobles, contacted these families about these cases that have been all but forgotten except for the family members, how did they react when they heard from you?
So we got some closed doors, but mostly when family members heard from us and from our students, they were deeply grateful to know that someone had remembered what happened. And if I have time, I'll tell you about one such encounter. One of our cases involved a man by the name of Edwin Williams, who was killed in 1942 in Algiers, which is a little area across the river from New Orleans. It's still part of Orleans Parish. Edwin Williams, in his 30s, 1942, walking home from church with his wife and two or three small children. His wife is carrying an infant. It's a Wednesday. They've gone to prayer service at the beautiful Zion Baptist Church. That's the name of the church. And three white sailors, throw beer on his wife and the infant. And Williams protests and says, you know, why? And the sailors are on a viaduct right above the street where the Williams family is. And they come down off the viaduct and they slash Williams to death with a beer bottle mm-hmm. in front of his wife and children. There is a trial for one of the sailors. He's acquitted, and the Coast Guard or Navy quickly ship him abroad to fight the war. He then returns to Texas, Bexar, Texas, where he grew up, lives a full life. The Williams family, on the other hand, essentially buries this event. About a year and a half ago, our student got the case. And she, first of all, searches a long time, and, you know, Edwin Williams in Louisiana, a hard guy to find. And ultimately, she finds James Williams. His name is Reverend James Williams. He's the pastor. He's now in his 70s. He's the pastor of the beautiful Zion Baptist Church in Algiers, and the son of Edwin Williams. And he was there when this happened. And my student, whose name is Erin McCrady, she's Irish American, calls Reverend Williams and says, we'd like to work with you. And he hesitates for a long time and many days. And eventually he says to her, "Did anything like this ever happen in your family?" And of course she has to say no. And I told Aaron, I said, "Aaron, go down to the next generation. They'll be interested." And she does. And Tracy, on Juneteenth of this year, at the beautiful Zion Baptist Church, all the Williams family, including the five sons, four boys, and then she adopted one relative's kid that she raised, the wife raised, they all came to the church. And they passed this story on in its fullness and accuracy to their loved ones and their family members. Those grandchildren knew they had lost their grandfather, but what the sons had told them was, as far as we know, he got into a fight on a street and he got the short end of the stick. They knew nothing about how their father, their grandfather, their relative had passed. And so I say that to say it's a range of responses, but we keep at it because at the end of the day, this history doesn't belong to us. It belongs to those families. Yeah.
One more question before we go to our audience, and that is, I'm wondering how you're thinking about the resistance that we're now seeing to this kind of history being shared, this scoffing at the idea of wokeness and the efforts to submerge these stories because we don't want anybody to feel bad. What are you thinking when you hear
about that? Plus ça change is what I can, all I can say, is that this is more of the same and that we just have to keep plowing along. And, you know, we have to pick our battles, but we got to pick a lot of them. Yeah. And, you know, I was a civil rights worker long before I got this project going, and born in Birmingham, Alabama, and knew nothing about these cases, knew absolutely nothing about these cases. And so our history can get lost. And we revived it, not just for history's sake. That's important. It's part of our history. It needs to be included in our history. But we also revived it because much as we talk about the new Jim Crow, we don't fully appreciate what the old Jim Crow was really all about. And much as we say, and it's widely accepted, it's basic science, social science, that the legacies of the old Jim Crow are our lived experiences today, much as we say that, we don't really know how that happens. Yeah. We don't know how these practices and modes of behavior and systems of hate are actually passed from one generation to the next. We know they are, but there's a lot we don't know. And so in order really to fill in the dots there in a dotted line, we have to recover the history. Yeah. And the third reason that we've done this is for the families, because as I've said, with respect to the James, to the Reverend Williams family, the families want to know. Yeah. It's their personal, it's our history. It's the history of our country. But for them, it's their personal family history. Yeah.
Well, on that note, why don't we go to our audience for your questions for Professor Burnham. Andy Seary's got a microphone, so just signal if you've got a question and we'll get a microphone to you.
Yeah, this is an unanswerable question, I know. But the first story you told, that Ollie Hunter, is that, did I get that right?
Yes.
What struck me about that is, if that one man hadn't written the letter, if that letter had not been filed somewhere, if one of your researchers hadn't come across it, we wouldn't know any of this. Do you have any sense of how small a tip of an iceberg all those thousands of things that you do
that's a great question, and if we have time at some point I'll read something where I meditate on that question of what X actually is. But let's get a couple of other questions and then I'll read. It's a great question. I don't know what X is.
So I want to run an idea past you, which is that I am very interested in how racism got started in America, and it feels to me like it was at the Bacon Rebellion, where black people and white people who rebelled against the landowners, because there was no more land in 1676 for them, they were all indentured servants at that point, to be able to make a living. So they rebelled and burned down Jamestown. And the solution was, when the rebellion was put down, that the white people who had rebelled were given a repeat of their indenture period. And the black people who rebelled were given an indenture for the rest of their lives. And the reason that that was done differently was that the white landowners, who were few in number, needed to divide the blacks from the whites who had similar interests. And it occurs to me that the worse off black lives look to the white people who have been elevated to whiteness. At that point, there was no language of white versus black. You were just identified by what country you came from or what religion you were or something. But that the more oppressed the black people were made to be, the more the white people did not want to have association with that or be treated that way. And Jim Crow seems like a very logical outcome of that system. How to keep rich white people elevated by dividing people who have common cause with each other, or should have, from each other.
I think obviously that's a, you know, fully accurate description. I'm not an expert on Jamestown. I don't think it's the origin of our country. I think our country starts in, nor do I think 1619 is the origin of our country. Our country starts in 1492, when the original occupants of this land were displaced, the beginnings of the displacement of the original occupants of this country that we now call our own. Yes, obviously Jim Crow is reiterative of the forms of divide and conquer that we've seen across from the period that you're talking about, the early generations through slavery, and on into the 1930s, 1940s, which is the period my book focuses on. I talk about Birmingham in the book, for example. So in the 1930s, you have, as I said, a very active kind of, united for that time, a moment in which the potential for white and black labor to organize on common ground, seems like it might be realized, but that quickly, or that at some point that dissipates, and then by the 1940s, you have the unions which are active in Birmingham are segregated. Black workers are limited to the black unions and to the worst jobs in the mines and the mills and the steel companies, and they live in segregated housing. And so, again, the view is, to keep folks, white folks, in the mines doing all this hard labor and keep exploiting them. The only way you're really going to do that, they call them the mules, the big mules of Birmingham. The only way they're really going to do that is showing them, emphasizing the advantages of their whiteness.
Hello. Did you ever experience any of the Jim Crow X?
Did you personally experience anything like that in your family?
Oh, well, yeah, I did. I was born in Slossburg Hospital for Colored Women in Birmingham, Alabama. So yes, I didn't stay in Birmingham long. My family moved pretty quickly to New York City. But I born in the South and then spent a good deal of my life in Mississippi. But this is not my personal story.
Hi.
So this book is, I assume, is kind of a side project from your larger research
database that you're putting together, what do you ultimately hope to do with the full database once, I mean, you're continuing to do more research into more cases, et cetera, more books from it, or what's your ultimate?
Well, you know, the database, so the book is, it's not, I wouldn't necessarily call it a side project. I worked on it a long time. But okay. But no, I take your point, though. So, you know, the database, our database follows on a set of data that were put together by two sociologists. The names were Tolney and Beck, who did a study of lynching and pulled and enumerated lynching cases from 1870 to 1930. And so we choose 1930 because although our database is not focused on lynching, we choose 1930 to carry on the work from where Tolney and Beck left off. When they published their work, which was in 1995, they published a database, they published a book called A Festival of Violence. There were a lot of other projects that used their material. So somebody in, you know, I don't know, Virginia would say, let's take a look at what's going on in Virginia. Maryland, what's happening in Maryland? What happened in Florida, right? So, you know, we can anticipate that the database will form the basis for other academic studies, right? We also expect that the database will help local journalists who don't have access to NARA or the Library of Congress. And so we've done that work for them. We've collected all the documents. We've put them in one place. All they need to do is bulk download, and then they can find out everything they ever wanted to know about racial violence in their, or racial, anti-black violence. Let me be quite specific here. This is really about African Americans. Anti-black violence in their town, Petersburg, or whatever the, Florida, or whatever the town might be. And then finally, the database is for families and communities, and you know, and local high school teachers who want to use this either to for pedagogical reasons or to better understand their local histories and to figure out ways communally they can address this.
Thank you for your role in revealing all this important information to readers and our country. My question is, could you comment on what you think, or why, just comment on the Republican Party and their current use of racism in taking power, keeping power, et cetera?
Well, what I will say is this. Without sort of commenting, let me try to keep my scholarly hat on here. What I will say is this. Colleagues of mine who have studied the 2016 election report that there are correlations between those counties, this is down to the county level, between those counties where the racial violence, anti-black violence, was most intense and the Trump vote. It is also true that, and this is a work that a colleague of mine at University in St. Louis, what do they call it? I forget it. WashU. It is also true that one of my colleagues found that if you trace areas where lynchings were averted, there were fewer Trump voters in those counties than in cases that had deeper lynching records, lynching histories. So we know that, you know, this stuff, like, it keeps growing. So these correlations are there. They don't entirely explain the Trump phenomena, but they are certainly one element. The correlations are demand explanation. Let me put it that way. They call out for other explanations, right? So, and there are 1,000 different ways people explain the Trump and the ongoing Trump disaster in our country, including, the needs and demands of working class white people that have not been fully respected. I mean, there's all kinds of theories about how Trump stepped into this vacuum. But what can't be ignored is that in those places where the history of racism, as evidenced by racial violence and other indicia, the other divides, housing, employment, health care, you know, all those other indicia of the deep divide in our country, that where those are deepest is where you find the most active Trump communities.
What do you say we have you read
sure,
a passage
I'd love
from the
to
book?
Read. So this goes to the question that was asked earlier about how do we know how many cases there actually are? After the murder of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 2020, a search of our archive of Jim Crow racial homicides revealed a striking but not shocking coincidence. A man of that same name was killed by a police officer in 1945. In October of that year, Thurgood Marshall received a letter from the secretary of the NAACP branch in St. Augustine, Florida, seeking an investigation into the, quote, untimely death of our brother George Floyd, whom we believe to have met his death unjustifiably so, close quote. 46 at the time of his death, the other George Floyd, a turpentine worker, was accused of being drunk on a Saturday evening and thrown into a cell in the St. Augustine jail. Floyd's protest against a second invasive search at the jail so incensed the arresting officer who had arrested him for drunk that he beat Floyd to death in the presence of other detainees and the jailer. Just two documents have survived from which to render an account of this killing: the investigation of the branch NAACP and the Florida death certificate. It was not entirely unforeseeable that we would find this name fellow in our archive pleading to be exhumed and put in conversation with the iconic inspiration for what would come to be known as the 2020 reckoning with black death at the hands of the state. After all, the Equal Justice Initiative identified more than 4,000 lynchings in the United States between 1877 and 1950. George Floyd's fate would not register in the EJI report. It was not a lynching. One might ask whether counting is even worth the candle if X is not ascertainable. In this case, we count for Floyd number one and Floyd number two. We count because George Floyd's younger brother, Charlie Floyd, beseeched the local branch of the NAACP to count. We count because the secretary of the branch wrote Thurgood Marshall in New York City and asked him to count. We count because George Floyd's paternal grandfather, Robert Floyd, was born into slavery in 1852, and with his paternal grandmother, also born a slave, had eight children. We count because across four generations of Floyds, the men worked in the woods chopping down the towering longleaf pines that would build our country and tapping out the turpentine to seal the boards on the ships that would transport our nation's merchandise. And the women cleaned houses, raised children, ran make-do infirmaries, and took in laundry. We count because for the Floyds, the bonds of slavery were replaced by unyielding indigence and debt. Monetary debt, yes, but also debt living within, quote, the calculus of blame and responsibility that mandated that the former enslaved both repay this investment of faith and prove their worthiness, unclose quote. We count because day after day and year after year, George Floyd worked in a forest alongside convicts whom he was only nominally freer than, from can't see in the morning until can't see at night, dipping turpentine. Recount because George and Rosa lived in the back of a camp that looked more like a prison, forbidden to keep a car on the premises because they might flee, and labored under the constant scrutiny of white boss men, even when the work was done. Recount the years of sweat and blood, never calculated, never compensated. Recount the suffering of the living and the savagery of the dying. We count because we do not know who preached George Floyd's funeral or where he is buried or what happened to the man who killed him. We count and contest because George Floyd counted number one and number two. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Professor Margaret Burnham, thank you for counting each and every one. Thank you for giving us this book and this history that is so important to all of us in our country. Thanks to all of you for joining us. One more round of applause for Professor Burnham.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.